You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Sojourner Truth Radio at 8. At 9, it's Sprouts, where we hear KHOI's Ursula Rudenberg speaking with infectious disease physician Dr. Mark Elaine Derry about the best ways we can take care of ourselves during the pandemic following COVID-19. At 9:30, Making Contact attorney journalist and election integrity advocate Jennifer Cohn talks about the threats of the U.S. electoral process and democracy. At 10, it's Radio Zine. KBOO's Suzanne LeGrand interviews Richard Loeb on their book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. At 10:30, it's Film at 11, a panel broadcast reviewing the latest films and shows from the multiplex to the art house and beyond.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee meets the third Monday of every month at 5 o'clock p.m.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we kick off the Sojourner Truth Election Watch. We get updates and analysis from Alan Minsky, Executive Director of the Progressive Democrats of America. And Wednesday, March 11th, marked the 9-year anniversary of the earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan, triggering the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident or disaster. There's a question whether or not it was an accident. We speak with the chief engineer of Fairwinds Energy Education and former nuclear industry senior vice president, Arnie Gunderson. Was the Fukushima disaster avoidable? What impacts did the disaster have in Japan, but also on the United States and elsewhere? For our weekly Earth Watch, we speak with Josie Tenorio Apestewa. She is of Hopi descent and an advocate for murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to kick off today's show with our weekly Earth Watch, and we're going to be focusing on the people are saying, referring to as a continuing genocide of Indigenous people, this time focused on the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. The Society of Indian Psychologists, they say that of 5,712 known cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, only 116 were logged in the Department of Justice database. And The Hill is also reporting that 3 out of 5 Native women have been assaulted in their lifetime. Over 1 in 3 will have been raped. There's growing concern about this epidemic, not only in the United States, but also across the border in Canada. And on March the 9th, marking International Women's Day, the International Women's Strike LA event brought together family members who had Their loved ones murdered in the serial murders of black women in South Los Angeles, together with family members of one of the missing and murdered indigenous women and girls. It was really an historic occasion, very, very moving. We're going to be posting, by the way, a video of not only that part of the program, but the entire program for March 7th in LA. So today we're really very glad to be able to continue the discussion on the missing and murdered indigenous women and girls. And I'd like to welcome Josie Tenorio Piestewa. Josie, welcome.
Good morning. Good morning.
Right, I see you. Your voice sounds like mine did a few weeks ago. Losing
yes.
it. Well, I'm so glad.
You know, unfortunately, as women and mothers, and we take care of our kids and are all out in the public, you can't avoid getting sick.
Yeah, yeah. I had laryngitis for quite some time. Josie, what I'd like to do is to play a clip from Al Jazeera. And this was a vigil held for missing and murdered indigenous women and girls across the so-named border in Canada. Let's go to that clip now.
Maggie Sywink's sister, Sonia, was murdered in 1994, yet she had so little faith in the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, she chose not to testify.
Families wanted the police killings that had taken place investigated. They wanted their missing brought home. So those kinds of things were never able to be, were not able to have been answered with this inquiry.
It's not that there hadn't long been calls for a specific investigation into the disproportionate violence directed at Indigenous women in Canada. Just 4% of the population, but 16% of reported nationwide homicides. Justin Trudeau followed through on his campaign pledge and announced the inquiry in 2015. And the inquiry's goal was not simply long-awaited official recognition of decades of brutality.
The work that we're going to be doing is research into systemic causes for the murders and the disappearances.
After 2.5 years and $68 million, it appears that the inquiry will basically state the obvious. The problem lies in the economic and social marginalization of Indigenous communities, institutional racism, violence, and indifference, and the all-out, quite overt cultural war waged against the Indigenous by the Canadian state.
I think it's really important as Canadians to recognize that many Indigenous women and girls who live in First Nation communities are living in third world conditions.
But while few will dispute the reported findings of the inquiry, some wonder what good any recommendations will be if the federal and provincial governments are the ones expected to be in charge of implementation.
It's a colonial government executing to a colonial government, and that is the reason why we have missing and murdered. It's genocide.
Canada is not the only country built on colonial violence, genocide, as the inquiry has reportedly found. But the government does have yet another opportunity to address that legacy on Monday. Shia Brittansi, Al Jazeera, Ottawa.
Okay, so an inquiry going on up in Canada, some questioning the effectiveness of it. Josie, I'm wondering if your thoughts on the family member who was being interviewed. She talked about poverty and institutional racism and cultural racism, as well as having a colonial government and Indigenous women living under third world conditions, and all of this together bearing some responsibility for the thousands of missing women and girls. Your thoughts, Josie?
Well, my thoughts on that, I think it's very not so much similar, because if you compare to Canada, to our people that is down here in this state, in our tribes, and I'm going to speak on my tribe itself, you know, there's a lot of human trafficking, and it goes back to a lot of the women that are going missing, and I have to include the men as well. Youth are going missing, and in the DCFS foster system. So I don't know how that plays a role from Canada, genocide, to here in California, in Hopi, in North Dakota, South Dakota. But I'll tell you this much, I do believe that everything does fall into, I might be contradicting myself in here, but give me a minute. Genocide has been raining our people for a very long time. Our women have been going missing and being murdered since day one, since settlers stepped in. And when I say settlers, when we were invaded by colonialism. After that, nowadays, for many years, women go missing and they blame it on drugs, they blame it on poverty, they blame it on the system. And in reality, a lot of the things that is happening in our reservation, like the pipelines, like the men that are also from the outside going in, tourists, and trafficking our women out, our girls, they're vulnerable. And yes, poverty may play a part in this. And sometimes it goes beyond. Maybe some family members, and it goes back to historical trauma, where many family members have been sexually abused. And that's where a lot of the trauma continues. So a lot of our women, a lot of our girls have been sexually abused. And when they find themselves vulnerable to other men and pick them up from our reservations or from foster homes, they find themselves, you know, caught up in that dark circle where they are being human trafficked, not only from state to state, but country to country. I live in California, and in California, I've met over 25 young ladies that have been trafficked, not only from our states, but from other countries, South America, Colombia, from Peru, from Guatemala, from Mexico, and then being trafficked down here. And the only way that they were saved is because they ended up in a place where they were able to find someone to trust.
Yeah, Josie, let me raise something with you here, though, because I'm from the Global South myself. I just want to push back a little bit on this issue in relation to poverty. Because we know that a lot of us who come from the Global South and come to places like the United States and the Global North, some of it has to do with the fact of fleeing violence, like the caravans we've seen coming from Honduras and El Salvador. A lot of it also has to do with poverty and the fact of really being economic refugees and going to the colonial powers, so to speak, that have profited off of our wealth. So from everything that we've seen, there is definitely a connection between poverty and immigration, but also between women who may be vulnerable because they're out on the street. That's what we found with the serial murders in South LA, which I've been very involved in. A number of them were caught up in the crack epidemic. Some of them were sex workers, not all of them were, but it means that they're a vulnerable population because they are illegal. So I imagine that there are likely similarities with the population of the missing and murdered indigenous women and girls. We know, for example, that the Trump administration, Interpol, and many others, they're really onto this human trafficking thing because they are interested not in protecting indigenous women and girls or not protecting impoverished black women on the streets, but to in fact create more laws. And when we know there are more laws, we know who are going to be the ones that are going to get cracked down on and end up in prison. And that's going to be people of color. Josie.
I agree with you. I definitely agree with you on that point.
Yeah.
One of the serious issues that we raised in LA until this day is stop labeling our young women that are being prostituted as what they used to use those words, being human trafficked. So the labeling has stopped. And before, as soon as the police would catch a youth being trafficked out in the street, they would call them prostitutes. That stopped, which was a big fight for us. We had advocated for that to stop for many, many years until recently, about maybe a couple of, I would say in 2000 to 2005, they changed that.
Yeah.
And now the youth that are being human trafficked, that's exactly what they're being helped and try to get some psychological, mental health stability and stuff. But when we talk inside our reservations, it's very different. Inside our reservations, we don't have that. Inside our reservations, the data has failed us, because all of our sisters that have been missing from our reservations is not on that data.
Yeah.
It's not collected. And even though the data that is collected now, that is recently collected, which has changed a bit, it's not accurate at all. There's so much human trafficking happening right now in South Dakota, North Dakota, huge, and right in Arizona, in Texas, in New Mexico, in Utah, in Montana, and many others, especially in Washington, Seattle, in the Yakima population, throughout other states. So much trafficking and so many women that go missing, especially our LGBTQ population.
Yeah,
and it
does seem, though, that there are definitely conditions on the reservations themselves. We know that Indigenous people are the most impoverished in the United States, and the sister in Canada who said a lot of Indigenous women and people are living under third world conditions, I mean global South within the global North conditions, undoubtedly leads to a lot of the violence, a lot of the vulnerability of the women that you're talking about, you know, the whole colonial, what has happened as a result of genocide and the colonial powers. But Josie, I'm feeling your voice. I haven't been in that situation. I know when I had it, it hurt when I talked. But in any case, we are out of time for this particular segment. But we want to thank you, Josie, even with your voice, to be able to come in and join with us. And we know that you have been organizing our prayer runs in many states, asking for justice for our sisters and brothers who have been murdered and missing, and we appreciate that as well. And we want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Watch. So Josie, take care of that voice.
Definitely will.
Some honey before and lemon and all of that. Thank
before
you.
Before we leave, can I just say something?
Sure.
That the 30 to 40% of our women that go missing and is being murdered is also due to domestic violence.
Yeah.
I really need to push that through, because
absolutely,
a lot of our women suffer domestic violence, and behind closed doors, they're never found, and there's never justice for them.
And similarly, in Black communities, there are a high level of domestic violence, and these are the kinds of things we don't like to talk about, because our communities are so under attack and facing racism, et cetera,
absolutely,
that a lot of folks, you know, don't want to deal with the domestic violence that goes on, with the femicide that goes on. We found with the serial murders of Black women in South Los Angeles that in a certain period of time, they were in a 40-mile radius of South Los Angeles. There were 5 serial murderers attacking and murdering and torturing Black women in a 40-mile radius. 5 of them, okay? So, and they were all Black men, by the way. And I think that made it very difficult for civil rights organizations and even some of the Black Lives Matter movements, et cetera, to really take up that cause, because these were Black men who were killing Black women. But the reality is that if our sisters are going missing, if our sisters are being murdered, we want justice, and we have to call it out, and we ourselves can't be part of that cover-up. So I appreciate you coming back and underscoring that point, Josie. Thank you.
Thank you. So no more stolen sisters, no more missing sisters.
That's right.
Equality to everyone.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much, Josie. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And I think what we'll do now, can we do an early station break? before we go into Arnie Gunderson, because that's a key segment. It's 9 years. I remember the morning coming into Sojourner Truth to start the show and having to revamp it all together when I saw that huge wave going into the tsunami, going into Japan on the screen. Unbelievable. We'll take a short break, and when we return, Arnie Gunderson.
What about sunrise? What about rain? What about dawn?
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:20 a.m. Now back to more Sojourner Truth.
What about all the things that you said was yours and mine? Did you ever stop to notice?
And that, of course, was the late Michael Jackson. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Spread the word, please. And also check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. We're also on SoundCloud around the nation and around the world. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners on Indigenous Lands Across the Americas. Indigenous Lands Across the Americas. And internationally, I would like to give a shout out to our listeners in my home island of Barbados. So we are now going to turn our attention to Wednesday, March 11th, marked the 9-year anniversary of the second worst nuclear disaster in human history. In 2011, 6 atomic power reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear site in Japan were severely damaged after a 9.0 magnitude earthquake in the Pacific Ocean rocked the area. The earthquake generated a 40-foot tall tsunami that overcame the plant's seawalls, flooding the nuclear site's lower levels. The earthquake and subsequent tsunami were responsible for close to 16,000 deaths, over 6,000 injured people. And interestingly, we don't know what has happened to the 2,529 people who are missing. This according to the National Police Agency of Japan. Now, as a result of the tsunami, there were 3 nuclear meltdowns, 3 hydrogen explosions, and mass contamination of the region. More than 160,000 people were forced from their homes after the meltdowns at the plant. This according to ABC News Australia. The plant's operator, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, they overlooked numerous warnings prior to the disaster and carried on business as usual. Actually, let's go now to a clip from CNN, because people had been pressing for accountability and justice for these TEPCO officials. But guess what? They were found not guilty. Let's go to that clip now.
A Tokyo court has cleared 3 former executives of negligence for the 2011 Fukushima disaster. They were accused of failing to implement safety measures. So let's turn now to CNN's Will Ripley for more on this. Good to see you again, Will. So it was the only criminal case to come out of the Fukushima disaster, and now the 3 executives have been cleared. How did this play out?
And all of this took more than 8 years, Rosemary. Normally, the Japanese judicial system might move more quickly. Prosecutors, they normally wouldn't take a case to trial unless they felt they had enough evidence to secure a conviction. But in this case, prosecutors declined to go to trial twice because they thought that the evidence was pretty flimsy and they didn't think they can get a conviction. And that's exactly what happened. Japan has a 99% conviction rate. But in this case, prosecutors simply were not able to prove that TEPCO's former chairman and 2 former vice presidents were negligent in the lead up to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear meltdown that was triggered by a 46-foot tsunami wave that overwhelmed the plant's ability to protect against natural disaster, causing a power outage and, of course, a meltdown that forced evacuations and that irreparably changed thousands of people's lives, especially those who had lived in the immediate vicinity of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. I've been to these abandoned villages many times, and I've spoken with relatives of people who died died in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the evacuation. More than 40 elderly patients had to be moved very quickly. And even though no deaths were directly attributed to radiation from the meltdown itself, the trauma of that event did cause some people who were already ill, already of a certain age, to die. And there are people, citizens in Fukushima, who have been demanding justice for years. In fact, it was a citizen judicial review panel back in 2015 that insisted that these three former executives go on trial, that somebody be held criminally responsible for what has happened, because there are still many civil lawsuits. Some penalties have already been awarded. Others are still making their way through the courts. And the reality is, after this result today, not a single person, more than 8 years later, will be held criminally responsible for the Fukushima Daiichi disaster, despite the fact that there is evidence that executives received briefings, briefings that told them that the plant might not be able to withstand the size waves that overtook the Fukushima Daiichi plant, and also briefings that warned of the fact that a large earthquake like the 9.0 earthquake that struck on March 11th of 2011 could create the kind of waves that would cause the power outage and the subsequent meltdown. Some have said that this is yet another example of Japan not really taking responsibility for what happened, and also what the International Atomic Energy Agency called basically a misguided faith by the Japanese in the safety of atomic power in the lead up to this. But also, the fact remains, Rosemary, plants just as old as Fukushima are still operating in Japan. Reactors have been restarted. The country still relies on nuclear energy, and it is a country that is highly prone to earthquakes and tsunamis. So there is real fear on the ground in Japan that this kind of thing could happen again if safety measures are not implemented. But once again, this case kind of bringing to light the fact that at least as it stands right now, not a single person will be held criminally accountable for what happened in Fukushima. Consequences still being felt. A million tons of radioactive water. They're trying to figure out exactly what to do with it. They might even have to dump it into the ocean, Rosemary.
Right. Well, a pretty good roundup, I'll have to say, from CNN. I do have to correct one thing, though, because they talked about no deaths. But in 2018, the Japanese government acknowledged for the first time that a worker at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear site died from radiation exposure following the disaster. The disaster was classified as a level 7 event, the highest level on the International Nuclear Event Scale by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and that has made it the second worst nuclear disaster in human history after the 1986 Chernobyl disaster in the former Soviet Union, in which there were at least 42 acute and prolonged deaths. Now, this week, on the 9th anniversary of the disaster, the Japanese government and mainstream media in Japan continue to frame what happened as an accident. We'll find out what our guests think about that. Officials from Tokyo and the nuclear industry are also bragging about how well they responded to in the days following the disaster. And the Japanese government and the nuclear industry have been covering up just how bad the impact of the disaster really was. And in that clip, you just heard that none of the TEPCO executives, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, were held accountable, even though there was obvious negligence, in my view. But Arnie Gunderson, we're really glad to have you back, because during that whole period, you were our go-to person. You were practically on nearly every day updating us on this. So Arnie Gunderson, welcome back.
Hi, Margaret. Yeah, thank you for having me back.
Yeah, and let me give you a proper introduction here to our audience. Arnie Gunderson is an energy advisor with almost 50 years of nuclear power engineering experience. He is the chief engineer of Fair Winds Energy Education and a former nuclear industry senior vice president. Now, he earned both undergraduate and graduate degrees in nuclear engineering, holds a nuclear safety patent, and was a licensed reactor operator. During his nuclear industry career, Arnie Gunderson managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants around the country. And currently, he goes on media, he speaks at public meetings on the need for a new paradigm in energy production. an independent nuclear engineering and safety expert. Arne Gundersen provides testimony on nuclear operations, reliability, safety, and radiation issues before congressional and state legislatures, government agencies, officials throughout the U.S., Canada, but also in internationally. So, Arne, we're glad to have your expertise here. Start by telling us.
Glad to be back. Thanks.
Yeah. Why do you think this, you have described what happened with Fukushima Daiichi as a man-made disaster? Why?
So we don't use the term accident. You know, an accident is when a tree falls on your car or a deer runs into your car or something like that. They can't be avoided. What happened at Fukushima definitely could have been avoided. It's a man-made disaster, but it's not an accident. And I think the nuclear industry and the Japanese government have tried to frame this as an accident. Oh, the deer jumped in front of my car. They really need to admit that all of the factors that caused the disaster were in place before the tsunami ever hit. We did a piece on our website that goes into this in detail. That's Fairwinds, FAIRWINDS.org. So the Fairwinds website covers on the 9th anniversary exactly the extent of the cover-up in Japan from the very first day until now with the Olympics coming. They are still covering up the extent of that disaster.
Yeah, and I suppose it was just such a shocking image that morning coming in and seeing the tsunami, literally watching it as it was approaching. It was caught on camera by somebody, I suppose. You know, that we had no idea the impact, not only on Japan, but also around the world. Now, contaminated water from this plant had been leaking anyway into the sea. And then, I think, was it last year, they had announced that they're going to be dumping Fukushima waste water into the Pacific. So what are your concerns around that?
Well, if you look at the Fukushima site now, take an aerial view. You can go up on Google and get aerial views. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of tanks holding radioactive water on the site. And the Japanese government's position is, we're running out of room. We don't have enough room to build any more tanks. But if you move out a little bit further, all of the land around it is so highly contaminated, nobody's using it. And if they just moved on to the land that surrounds their property and built more tanks, they could store this stuff for decades to come. What's happening is the groundwater is leaking into the nuclear reactor and into the containment, and the containment is highly contaminated. So instead of the radioactive core melting down into the groundwater, what's happened is that the containment has failed, and the groundwater is leaking into the containment through cracks and man-made holes. So they're storing it. And the plan is, Japan doesn't want to build any more tanks, and the plan is that they're going to dump 1 million tons of this radioactive water into the Pacific. It's illegal. There are international protocols that prevent it, but that doesn't seem to stop the Japanese government from doing anything. And what it contains is radioactive tritium, but also radioactive cesium and especially radioactive strontium. So they're going to pump 1 million tons of water into the Pacific, and, you know, dilution is the solution to pollution. Off the coast of L.A. right now, we're already detecting Fukushima radiation, cesium, and other isotopes.
Oh, my goodness.
And, of course, this will increase the amount of radiation in the Pacific. You know, you throw 1 million tons of radioactive water into the Pacific, and you're going to increase the amount of radiation in the Pacific.
Yeah, and what about the creatures, the beings who live in the Pacific? Do you know what I mean? Like, what happens then with the whales, with the fish, with the dolphins, and there's a huge fishing industry. A lot of people are then eating the fish there. I mean, there's bound to be some kind of impact.
Well, I've taken a personal position, and this is a personal position, that I don't buy fish from the Pacific. I'll get them from the Atlantic or elsewhere, but not from the Pacific. The radiation levels in fish are lower than international standards, but that doesn't mean they're safe. You know, any amount of radiation can induce a cancer. And Pacific fish have more radiation than Atlantic fish. So the closer you get to Japan, the higher those concentrations are. But the net effect is that the higher up you go in the food chain, there's this thing called bioaccumulation. You know, the little fish eat the grasses that have absorbed the radiation, and they accumulate it. And then the little fish get eaten by bigger fish that get eaten by bigger fish, and up the food chain it accumulates. And the net effect is that, you know, the tuna and the barracudas and the other top of the food chain predators have radiation attributable to Fukushima in their tissue. Now, if you eat it, the position of the nuclear industry is just so little, you won't get cancer. But what the real position should be is, if you eat it, the statistical chance of you getting cancer is lower than if you eat a fish that had more radiation, but it's not zero. So the more people that eat fish, the same number of people are going to get cancer, but they're going to be spread out over the entire Pacific basin, and epidemiologically it's going to be really hard to catch, to identify those cancers, just because there's a couple billion people on the edges of the Pacific. But the net effect is that people will get cancer from eating fish and bottom dwellers from the Pacific, and it's just statistically, it will be very difficult to identify because so many billions of people live along the Pacific.
That's right, and depend on fish, you know, for their livelihood and also to eat. I mean, when you're living, I grew up on an island, and when you are in that kind of environment, you know, the fishing boats are out, they come in, and, you know, fish is like, was just a regular part of our daily diet. And thank goodness, it's a lot more expensive now, but back then, you know, it was something that was also affordable for low-income people. I mean, you basically hardly ate meat at all, except on special, or even chicken, except on special occasions. So I imagine that there's still quite a lot of people who are going to be eating this fish out of the Pacific.
The way the plume spread, there are some very dramatic representations of radiation spilling out across the Pacific, but they're wrong. It didn't flow out uniformly across the whole Pacific. There's a thing called the Northern Japan Current, and the Pacific flows north from Japan and then across the Aleutian Islands, down through Alaska,
yeah,
British Columbia, and down the west coast of the United States. So the Pacific Islands are actually on the end of that train, not at the beginning of that train. You know, for instance, Hawaii, the Northern Japan Current bypassed Hawaii, and now, of course, it's getting diluted into the whole Pacific. But initially, all the radiation went north across the Aleutians and then down the California coast.
Yeah. Yeah, and Arnie, just finally, I mean, there's so much I want to talk with you about. You'll have to come back soon and dig a bit more into this, because we know that Germany, for example, announced that they were going to get rid of all their nuclear power plants. It's easy for people to think, well, I don't live along the Pacific coast, or I'm not in Japan, I'm not impacted by it. But actually, here in the U.S., leaks have been found at many nuclear power sites. Isn't that the case? It was a report, some reporting from AP talking about radioactive tritium that has leaked from three quarters of U.S. nuclear sites, often going into ground water from corroded buried piping. We already know there's a big issue with lead in the water, but people may not know about this. So,
yeah, I'm sure you'll have me back on because in about 2 months, we're going to be publishing a peer-reviewed paper about the Woolsey Fire. And the Woolsey Fire started on the Santa Susana nuclear site.
That, of course, was in Southern California.
Yeah, right in your backyard. So I can't go into the details of the study yet because when you peer review, you're not allowed to announce your conclusions. Separately, we're going to have another paper out about the Olympic venues in Tokyo and contamination at them. But again, I can't get back. I can't go into the details until the peer review report.
Well, you'll have to put us on your calendar, Arnie, and just be back. let's dig a bit deeper in that. We so appreciate your work and also the work of Maggie Gunderson, that we know she's very involved in all this. We are out of time now, though, Arnie, because we're kicking off our election watch today. So, okay. And you know, there's a lot going on there. But let's be back in touch and schedule. I'll be in touch with Maggie. Schedule you to be back on as soon as possible.
Please have your readers go to fairwinds.org. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Arnie Gunderson.
Yep,
this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, on Tuesday, March 10th, Senator Bernie Sanders faced a major loss in the delegate race on Super Tuesday to rival candidate Joe Biden. Biden won in four states. He won in Idaho, Michigan, Missouri, and Mississippi. Michigan was an especially hard loss for Bernie Sanders and his supporters. Meanwhile, Bernie won outright in North Dakota, and it's still the toss-up. It's still a toss-up. Our guests could fill us in on that in terms of Washington State. So on Tuesday, Biden received 184 delegates, while Bernie got 112. Biden currently is at 864 total delegates, while Bernie has 710. This according to the New York Times. Now, next week, there are going to be primaries in Arizona, in Florida, Illinois, and Ohio. And the following week, there'll be primaries in Georgia. Now, things really flipped because after the resounding victory of Biden in South Carolina, buoyed by the black vote, there seems to be like a run. You know, in the U.S., people have a thing of like, I want to go with a winner. But before bringing our guest in, also, Bernie won in California. They're still counting votes in California. But another significant loss was Texas. And I want to discuss with our guest why that may be the case. I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Alan Minsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America. Alan is a lifelong activist, worked as a progressive journalist for the past two decades. He was the program director at KPFK Los Angeles from 2009 to 2018, and he regularly coordinated Pacifica Radio's national political coverage. Before that, Alan Minsky was one of the founders of LA Indie Media. He's also worked with The Nation magazine and Jacobin on their audio projects and has been a regular contributor to Common Dreams and Truth Dig. Alan, there's a lot more I can say about you, including your involvement with Occupy Wall Street, but let's get to our election watch here. Welcome back, Alan Minsky.
Thank you, Margaret. Good to be with you.
So, Alan, everybody now is looking to see how this race has shifted and how things are shaping up. I'll have to say I know that a lot of our listeners are Bernie supporters. I can't, of course, endorse a candidate on certainly not on the air against FCC regulations. But for people who are Bernie supporters now, how do you... what are your thoughts on his decision that he's going to stay in the race and what that might mean moving forward?
I think his very brief announcement yesterday was a really powerful statement, and it was necessary, in my opinion, for him to stay in the race. This all turned so very quickly. You mentioned the result in South Carolina, and two things were true in the days leading up to South Carolina in so many people's mind. One is that Bernie Sanders, at that hour after the Nevada caucus, was the prohibitive front runner and with a clear path to the nomination, to win the Democratic Party nomination for president, like no other candidate in the race. And the second was that the person who had been the front runner for the previous year, Joe Biden, had seemed basically buried. He had done terribly in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And then the comeback was it was like a snap of the fingers, and you blinked, and you go just a few days later, and all of a sudden, Biden has won South Carolina. He has swept many of the Super Tuesday states by margins that were unthinkable. The situations were reversed, only you were much further down the road. And, you know, it speaks to the insanity of the process. This was true the last cycle with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, that Super Tuesday happened immediately after South Carolina. And again, it was South Carolina followed by Super Tuesday, where Bernie Sanders fell behind in the delegate count and could never make up the deficit. However, Super Tuesday in 2016 wasn't as large as this. California wasn't a part of it. So even as Sanders was further behind, as he did make comebacks later in the process, it got drawn out much longer because there was always California way out on the horizon. And there was always the thought that, you know, if he can pick up this state or that state and just stay in it, then this could be resolved all the way down the road in California. Now California's already played out. So this is an insane process. That, like, for a whole year, it's just getting started. There's a debate with 20 candidates. There's a debate with 40 candidates. Then there's a debate with 12 candidates. And it takes forever to get going. And then finally, Iowa happens. That was crazy this year. New Hampshire happens. Sanders is gaining momentum. Biden is fading. And then all of a sudden, South Carolina and Super Tuesday, and it's almost over. And so that's where we are. It happened so quickly. And I think just because of all of that dynamic, it's really essential that Bernie Sanders stay in the race, so that he can at least have what he has earned the right to, which is a one-on-one debate with Joe Biden.
Which,
of course, will take us on Sunday.
Yeah, let me ask you this. Let's unpack this a little bit here. I mean, we all know and we understand, and Alan, you and I have had many conversations, one-on-one conversations, about the importance of the black vote and the quote-unquote black problem that Bernie has in terms of his ability to pull out the black vote, except for young black people who overwhelmingly are with Bernie. So there's a generational divide between older black people and younger black people. And a number of black people that I've talked to, they're like, yeah, we're voting for Biden because we think that he's the candidate that white people, liberals and moderates, will support. And they won't support Bernie, but everybody seems to love Bernie's platform, even the Medicare for All platform. But having said that, I just wanted to ask you about Texas and the turning out the youth vote. I happen to think that if Bernie had won Texas, you know, it wouldn't have seemed like this runaway, the runaway train as it's looking right now with Biden. And the reality is that young people turned out in fewer numbers in this primary, not only in Texas, but in a number of states where Bernie lost than even last time. Any explanation or any thoughts on why that is the case?
Well, I think it goes again to the difficulty of the American process, the difficulty. Young people in American society today, this is, of course, a big subject. There's a lot of economic precarity. There's a lot of work in a gig economy. There's a lot of moving around, and that's very important when you have to be registered in a specific location. States like Texas make it as difficult as, you know, it's right up there in terms of being one of the most difficult states to get registered into. So you're talking about not only, you know, mobilizing a group of people to participate in a process that they've largely been alienated from up until Bernie Sanders appears as a national political figure who's very attractive to American youth. And then you have to not just get them mobilized to vote, but to go through the process of registering them. And then, of course, in Texas, there were incredibly long lines, especially on university campuses and college campuses where young people were concentrated. But, you know, it's just a crazy thing. You know, I hate to emphasize this kind of competitive horse race aspect of what transpired because, of course, Bernie Sanders represented a direct challenge to the Democratic Party establishment. I mean, Sanders says that there's just no way to overstate how much of a reality that is.
Yeah, so, and I mean, the mainstream media, I mean, liberal media like MSNBC, I mean, they're just thrilled with what's happening now. They were so anti-Bernie, it was outrageous. But on this question of young people voting, though, I mean, it's easy to say, young people, just go out and vote, all right, which is something I would say. But also, we have to realize that the voter suppression laws that have increased since the last presidential race, some were in place back then as well. And given the economic situation of young people, a lot of them working in temp jobs, working odd hours, maybe holding down 3-4 jobs, entry-level positions, etc., you know, that was the analysis that was mentioned in the Washington Post, Philip Bump in the Washington Post. And I do think that we have to pay some attention to that. It's not simply young people are just too lazy to go out and vote. Some of that may be the case, but there were other reasons as well that, because Bernie's big point is that he's increasing the base. He will bring out more people to vote. But yet, when we look at the vote count among young people, his strongest base, that has not happened, it seems, looking at the numbers. Alan Minsky.
Yeah, no, it was a very dynamic situation. It's very different, by the way, than 2016. And I think the main difference, of course, is that it really was just two candidates in 2016. This time, there were so many candidates. And, you know, there certainly were efforts on behalf of a number of the other campaigns to try to make themselves attractive to younger voters. They didn't really achieve that at all. Sanders remained prohibitively the favored candidate. But I just bring that up because the whole thing just seemed, you know, much less clear and confusing, and how much that may have contributed to, at the end of the day, not that much of a larger turnout. And I think actually in raw numbers there has been an increase among young voters across the country. And of course, given that they're voting overwhelmingly for Sanders, but, you know, then you have
to... Well, it'll be good to see those numbers, because it certainly is challenging the narrative that's the media, for the most part, are putting out there about the drop in numbers. But just very quickly, we only have a few minutes left. A lot of people are surprised and a bit concerned about Elizabeth Warren and her refusal to endorse Bernie right now. And many people are seeing that as a silent endorsement of Biden, or maybe her waiting to be invited by Bernie for a VP slot. A quick thought on that. But also, just to mention that in a poll, a Biden-Trump poll, the source being the Morning Consult, Biden is at 41% and Biden is at 48% and Trump is at 41%. And Bernie versus Trump, real clear politics. Bernie is 50%, Trump 45%. So both of them still beating a Trump. And a Biden versus Trump from real clear politics has Biden at 50.7% and Trump at 44.4%. I know a lot of people are very skeptical of polls given what happened last time, but just some final thoughts from you, Alan Minsky.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this quickly, try to cover a lot of territory here. I think Bernie Sanders has only really one shot given where the numbers are right now, and that is to really just totally dominate and win very clearly the debate on Sunday. That's not an impossibility. Joe Biden has had a lot of trouble, making a clear expressions of what he stands for. One of the terrible paradoxes of the situation we're in is basically Joe Biden was able to be propelled from being, having been a defeated candidate into just overnight being returned to being the prohibitive nominee without any clear sense among voters of what he stands for when it comes to policies. What he stands for is he was Barack Obama's vice president, and he represents somehow some kind of political stability. And, and he has a magnetic smile, and he seems confused when he talks for longer than about a sentence at a time. But when you look back at this race, and I really do think this is true for Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, first of all, and again, I really encourage people to go and just find the short press conference that Bernie Sanders did yesterday where he announced that he was staying in the race and was looking forward to the debate, and even check out his appearance last night on Jimmy Fallon. This person is a historic figure of the highest order in our society's history, and he responds to the clear issues that are of importance to people throughout the society and the society as a whole. I think when you do look at the candidates, the proliferation of candidates who ran, in all respect to everyone else, Elizabeth Warren was the only other person up there on the stage who really has a body
and
career where... Yeah.
I hate to say this. Yeah. I've got like 15 seconds to get out of here, but we'll have you back. Okay.
Yeah.
So
Sanders and Warren are characters who are head and shoulders above the rest. Obviously, it was a very difficult process. You get these two longtime allies into a competition. Looks like
it was
a difficult thing in terms of their relationship. But alas. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you, Alan Minsky. We have to dash. I'd like to thank all of today's guests. Sorry to not have the time to thank everybody today, our audio engineer, our assistant producer. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:56 a.m. Next up, we have at 9 o'clock, Sprouts, where we hear KHOI's Ursula Rudenberg speaking with infectious disease physician Dr. Mark Allen Derry about the best ways we can take care of ourselves during the panic following COVID-19. At 9:30, we have Making Contact attorney, journalist, and election integrity advocate Jennifer Kahn talking about threats to the U.S. electoral process and democracy. At 10, we have Radio Zine's KBOO's Suzanne LeGrand interviews Richard Louvre on their book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. At 10:30, it's Film at 11, a panel broadcast reviewing the latest films and shows for the multiplex to the art house and beyond. Then at 11, it's an encore episode of The Digital Divide from 2014, featuring an interview with MAPS Director of Marketing Brad Burge, host Rabian Yeaman, talks with Rick about FDA-approved research and testing with various psychedelics under clinical conditions. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Censored Film Screening of United States of Distraction, Fighting the Fake News Invasion on Wednesday, March 25th from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. United States of Distraction is an analysis of how fabricated information poses a threat to democracy. The film will be followed by a Q&A with film contributors Nolan Higgin and Mickey Huff. Again, that's United States of Distraction, Fighting the Fake News Invasion, on Wednesday, March 25th, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th Ave in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is hiring. We're currently accepting applications for our volunteer and outreach coordinator position. We're looking for someone with experience in volunteer management and outreach to diverse communities and preferably has experience with nonprofits. This is a full-time position. For the full job description and instructions on how to apply, see the job listing on our website at kboo.fm/employment. Applications are due Saturday, March 22nd by 5 p.m. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9 a.m. and it's time for Sprouts.
Local stories to a global audience produced at a different location every week.
The majority of all human viruses were all zoonotic. They transferred from an animal over to a human. We as human beings circulate coronaviruses pretty readily with one another, and our immune system is somewhat acclimated to those coronaviruses. But what's unique about this one is that it hasn't circulated amongst human beings, because we're seeing this one happen in real time, and it's going to take some time for our immune system to become acclimated to it, probably 5 to 10 years before it just becomes one of the common colds.
I'm Ursula Rudenberg from Pacifica Radio Network, and for the next half hour, we're going to talk coronavirus. Mark Allendary, infectious disease doctor from New Orleans, will share information with us about the Nova coronavirus COVID-19, what it really is, how it will likely affect our lives, and he'll share some valuable information about things you can do and think about as the virus approaches your community. Here's Mark Allen.
Hello, my name is Dr. Mark Allendary. I'm an infectious diseases doctor with Access Health of Louisiana, which is a federally qualified healthcare clinic in the state of Louisiana. And I'm in New Orleans, Louisiana.
And you're with a community radio station as well, right?
That's right. I'm the founder of the community radio station 102.3 WHIV LP.